animals are in the water, so we can wound them and slow them down and then recover them. If we use high caliber rifles, that may kill the walrus instantly and it'll sink. And also, if we use high caliber rifles, you know, 7mm or 300 Magnum on a walrus, a lot of times the bullet will go right through that walrus and wound another walrus. And those were some of the things that they were concerned about. And the other one was enforcement. How is Fish and Game going to enforce the walrus hunters to make sure that they used only those higher caliber rifles to kill walrus? Are they going to board these boats and make sure that they have only those large caliber rifles? And the other concern was that most hunters do not go strictly out to hunt walrus. When they go hunting, they're looking for seals, they're looking for walrus, they're looking for ungroup, and not strictly for walrus, and therefore need these other smaller caliber rifles to hunt these marine mammals. And this suggestion that the sport hunters use these higher caliber rifles is in fact a reaction to that proposal that was put by Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Whether it was adopted, I don't know. Methods of harvest. There shall be, or there will be, no indiscriminate firing into herds of walrus. There shall be no unnecessary harassment of walrus. Reporting and marketing, or marking. The captain or hunter shall report all takes of walrus and other marine mammals to the Eskimo Walrus Commission representative. Staff will develop marine mammal calendar. And this is, I'm getting to the part that I was going to say earlier in regards to recreational hunting. Recreational hunting. Recreational hunting will be conducted in an adventurous and pioneering spirit using native guides and crew. All rules of Section 401 or 4.1 shall apply. That means in terms of the required equipment. The recreational hunter shall have one chance, one shot, of harvesting the Pacific walrus. If the Pacific walrus is not brought down, then the backup native shooter will kill the animal for the hunter. And let me go back to history a little bit. Many of these professional hunters that came up to hunt the walrus, in a lot of times, did not know how to shoot the walrus to kill it. I won't say most of them, but some of them, I said they, you know, were in this category, that they did not know where to shoot the walrus to kill it. And in other cases, they would wound the walrus and they would escape and perhaps die later. And the Walrus Commission wanted to avoid this kind of thing happening, where a professional hunter would shoot the walrus, wound it, and then they might keep shooting it and he crawls off the ice and goes under and is, you know, escapes. That this provision was to allow the professional hunter one shot, one try to kill the walrus, and if he didn't, then the native hunter would kill the walrus on their behalf. It's a unique reasoning in this case, and something that probably the professional hunters would not want to see ever adopted, because it restricts their ability to one shot at one time only.
Caleb, we have to adjourn just a little early for lunch, so would this be a convenient time to break off?
Sure, and, that's fine. Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll come back at 1 o'clock and just carry on with Caleb Pangawi's presentation then. Do you want to speak to Jim? I've forgotten what's next here.
Sometimes I look over at Steve Dickey and I look like
I'm going to do this program. I guess everything's fine. We'll just go in that order then. Everybody knows it, so I guess there's no problem. Yeah.
On your round table set, there's almost.
Yeah, this is the Walrus Commission's proposed, regulations. It's nothing that's a permanent thing, but something that they proposed over the years.
Well, look.
We don't have a representation here.
Well, maybe tomorrow, okay?
I can't tomorrow. I'm going to stay out of here.
Well, wait till the latter part of the afternoon. We'll have a coffee break around 3. See how far we've gotten.
It's very short.
Yeah, these, I don't think they've been, they've never...
Well, maybe we should take our seats and begin again. Caleb and Marie and I were doing a program for APRN. So, okay, well, why don't you start again, Caleb, and we'll just carry on.
Okay. Well, I'll try not to carry any too much further, knowing the time limits. Let me read a few more of the provisions of the proposed management plan of the Wildlife Commission. Subpart F is regulations on enforcement. It says, purpose of regulations. It is the purpose of the regulations contained herein to A, ensure an efficient subsistence harvest of walrus, and B, provide a means within the Alaska Eskimo customs and institutions of limiting the walrus harvest within section 1.4 in order to prevent the extinction of such species. Okay, part of this is cut off, so I'm not able to read fully part of it. The Eskimo Walrus Commission is empowered to administer the regulations contained herein to ensure the purposes in section 6.1 of these regulations. One, acting as an enforcement agent for any governmental entity authorized to enforce these regulations. B, the Walrus Commission is empowered to promulgate interim regulations that are in addition to, but not inconsistent with, the regulations contained herein. International cooperation, international agreement. Promote and be included in the negotiations of an international agreement with USSR regarding the management and conservation of the Pacific walrus. And that pretty much contains most of the proposed regulations that have been adopted by the Walrus Commission. One thing that they have not done is approach the enforcing agency, in this case the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and says, these are our proposed regulations, and in absence of the federal management, we would like to institute these regulations on our behalf. And the other thing is that the state of Alaska is now in the process of seeking the return of marine mammal management to the state of Alaska from the federal government. The Walrus Commission has asked or seek to be a participant in those negotiations with the federal government in regards to the management of marine mammals, particularly walrus. But the response from the Department of Fish and Game has been that they don't want to involve their private interests in their negotiation with the federal government, meaning the native people in this case, and also possibly the sportsmen that would be interested in getting involved in the hunting of marine mammals. I think it is of importance, and the Walrus Commission really feels this, that since they are the primary users of these resources, that they should be involved in the negotiation with the federal government in regards to the return of management of marine mammals to the state of Alaska. We might also add that the 1981 amendments to the Marine Mammal Protection Act were done without the involvement of the Native community. Although Alaska Federation of Natives was represented by Don Mitchell. In our opinion, it was a long-range representation in that once in a while he would call us up and says, hey, this particular proposal is being considered. What is the position of the Wabash Commissioner or the Native community? And it was difficult to, I think the Native community should have been intimately involved in those amendments on the reauthorization of the Marine Mammal Protection Act in 1981. As a result of that, I think there are some provisions in the, those amendments that will potentially be harmful to the Native community. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Caleb. Any questions that you'd like to direct to Caleb or to Weaver Ivanoff or Dolly or Ron? Bob Gamble.
One of the things you mentioned, Caleb, that I was particularly interested in was that one of the principles in the formation of this commission was the integration of traditional and modern scientific knowledge. I wonder how that's worked out in a practical sense.
We were kind of discussing that earlier in our interviews in the station, and that there is, you know, new technology that has been applied to some of our subsistence hunting activities, the high-powered rifles, the outboard motors, and some of those things that increase the mobility and ability of our people to harvest marine mammals. I don't think it has really affected the subsistence activities of the native population, nor has it affected the populations that people have, I don't know how to term it, have used for subsistence resources. When you look at the Marine Mammal Protection Act and the animals that are in it and the resources that are used by the native people, those populations that are used by the native people have not suffered, but those that have been affected by commercial fishing have been affected by some of the other activities. So I think in that sense, the although the means have changed, the feeling or the meaning behind it has not changed.
I think maybe you misunderstood my question. I was talking about in the application of traditional knowledge and the marrying of that with Western scientific methods and knowledge in terms of making decisions about harvest allocations and so forth. Has that ever been tested or applied?
Not in this case, no. You must realize that these proposed regulations have not been enforced or have not been applied to the management of marine mammals. I think that's what they're trying to say in this case, that any kind of regulations that are being proposed, that there be village involvement, that if there's going to be some decision that are going to be affecting the habitat, that the user group or the what they said in this case, in terms of habitat, that those people that are, let me try to find it. After consultation with immediate area users. In other words, you know, they're saying that it should not be done without the knowledge or consultation, you know, or concurrence from the users.
Anything you'd like to add, Ron?
No, I think Caleb's just about said it all. He gave a pretty good presentation.
Okay. Tom Lohner and then Marie Adams.
Caleb, you mentioned some newly promulgated changes to the Marine Mammal Protection Act dealing with walrus that you said in the long run or even in the near term might prove difficult for you. What are those changes exactly?
Okay. Not having those amendments in front of me is difficult, but I can answer some of the things. One is that the state and the environmentalists convinced the federal government that there must be some tagging and monitoring of the harvest of marine mammals by the native population. And the feds are now being forced to do that or else be in contempt of the law. So they're now developing means in which they can tag walrus ivory, tag seal skins, tag polar bear skins, so that if the state should take over management, that these kind of practices will continue under state management. But they're also being required, even if there's no state management, that if the federal management continues, that these regulations will be used or these kind of tagging will be used. So that's one thing that I think is can be detrimental. The other portion is that whereas currently the hunting is without regulation, that there is potential for regulated hunts, be it the quota system, the bag limits, and some of those things. But I also want to also point out that there is two divisions within the federal government that apply to, in this case, the walrus. One is the Fish and Wildlife Service that kind of keeps track of the biological part of the animals and keeping track of the numbers. The other portion is the law enforcement division that supposedly to enforce the law and make sure that what is done is being done. A lot of times the two don't speak to each other, I guess, and they create problems for one another. And they want, you know, a lot of times the Fish and Wildlife people say, you know, why don't those law enforcement people listen to us? Because, you know, what they're doing a lot of times will alienate the native people. Okay, in other words, when there's alienation, then there's lack of cooperation. And I think that's something that, you know, should be said.
If I might follow up with just one additional question. Is the Walrus Commission on record as opposing or supporting a transfer of management back to the state?
Ron, answer that.
We discussed this the other day, and we were still neutral when we met back in Nome. But towards the end of the meeting, the commission had decided that they were going to oppose state transfer. But later on, we changed it so going to remain neutral until Fish and Game has had a chance to meet with all the villages, and then they'll make their decision then.
Thank you. David wants to add something
to Tom's question about the amendments too. I'm getting this from memory, but I'm pretty sure I've got it right. The main thing about the amendments to the Marine Mammal Protection Act is that they removed the native-only exception when and if jurisdiction is ever returned to the state, and converted it into a rural subsistence user exception, paralleling the D2 legislation. So the result is, as long as management, then there is an exclusive native exemption with effectively few or no regulations. And if it goes back to the state, then it will be subsistence user exemption, which is a pattern that we're beginning to see in the treaty and negotiations and other statutes.
Yes, that's exactly what I was going to say. That was the major amendment change in 1981 that has potential detrimental effect to the natives, and as Caleb had stated, was changed without consulting the native resource users who would be affected by the change.
Marie Adams, did you have a question?
I don't have any particular questions right now, but there were several things I wanted to comment on in regards to Caleb Pangawi's presentation. He mentioned that there was a great deal of publicity that was harmful, and we've experienced that also, but also the problems that they were experiencing in regards to that publicity were also impacting other areas of subsistence. You know, so was our publicity on the whaling matter. I think it's important for people to understand that in regards to subsistence, when one resource is having problems, then people tend to sort of go across the board and say there's a problem with subsistence all across. And we've experienced that with publicity that was given to the walrus problem. I don't consider it a problem with the situation there. And also in regards to weapons, I would like to give some support to what they were saying, that they should have the ability to maintain their hunting methods because they're the ones who would know best. And when in our situation, there's been attempts to make changes, and those are very difficult for, it's very difficult for people to accept those changes because they know the methods that they've developed have been developed over centuries, some of them, and some of them by adoption to make their hunt more efficient. So to try and attempt to change that from the outside would only be detrimental. And I think in regards to having our own meetings and the other subject, having our meetings, we basically do the same thing. There are some things that the Eskimos would reserve, and a lot of it is because we, and I'm sure the Walrus Commission does the same thing, it's we maintain or keep some things to ourselves, but that's because it would appear secretive, but it's because we're so often attacked and so often put on the defensive for things that people don't really understand about subsistence. And I wanted to add to his comments related to that.
Thank you, Marie. Well, maybe we should thank...
I've got a question.
Oh, sorry.
Caleb, you mentioned use of, or perhaps it was non-use, of local people in fish and game research. And I guess I'd like to ask Steve Behnke if there is a policy within the Department of Fish and Game that would, or can you foresee one, that would permit local people to be used in those capacities in order to fulfill the Fish and Game Department's mission?
I think Caleb probably is a lot more familiar with the local situation up there. At times there has been cooperation in terms of gathering some kinds of information, hasn't there, Caleb?
Maybe I can answer it in a little different manner, is that since we don't have the doctors and the master's degrees behind our names, that those kind of research things are normally done by people who have gone through the university system and not, you know, the local people.
Steve Behnke?
I think that my division doesn't get involved in, the Division of Subsistence doesn't get involved in the kinds of biological research that you're mainly talking about here. But one of the ways that we've tried to do is develop joint projects where we have people who have the academic credentials and also people who work in communities, and we see those things as you know, joint kinds of projects. I think that the same model could apply in biological work. I guess the question that Caleb raises about you know, what emphasis or whether people listen to people, you know, who don't have the professional credentials is a, I mean, that is a problem in the in the system. Of course, we also have the other pieces of that is that in the advisory, the local fish and game advisory system, there is opportunity for people to testify before the Board of Fisheries and the Board of Game on, you know, their views. And I think that the adequacy, whether or not that, you know, the role that testimony plays in the board's consideration really varies a lot. There's a lot of factors that are relevant there. I think that there are a lot of situations where the Board of Game relies heavily on local people's observations about resource situations. In other cases, they weigh that kind of testimony against or with biologist testimony about things.
Is biological research handled in a different division then entirely within the Department of Fish and Game?
It's handled on game wildlife questions, it's handled by the Division of Game. On fisheries questions, it's handled between this Division of Sport Fishery and the Division of Commercial Fisheries.
And so the Subsistence Division doesn't actually do biological research, it does mainly sociological
research. That's correct, we do socioeconomic research. We also conduct some harvest studies, and in those cases we cooperate with other divisions in the department and also with local communities.
Dolly?
I had a comment on your question as to the hiring difficulties. With both Fish and Game and with the Fish and Wildlife Service, it is required that interested persons get on a register. And to qualify for the registers generally requires some type of education, often 1 to 2 years of college or so many credits or past work history. Often the residents in the Northwest area don't have those college credits necessary. And even if they do, may be unaware of the register deadlines, which may be up to 6 months in advance of when the job would actually open. And so there has been a lot of difficulty in terms of getting residents employed in those areas.
And that's true for both the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service and State
yes.
Fish and Game?
Yeah, Steve Benke.
The previous comment was real accurate. I'm real aware of those difficulties because, and probably Tom Lahner and others who've worked for the department are too. Because when the Division of Subsistence was created, we immediately saw that one of our major needs was to be able to hire people out in local areas to help us compile socioeconomic information, and we battled with the state administrative system, the procedures for being able to hire local people for a number of years, and over the years we've improved our record considerably. We've developed a way that we can get local people who have bilingual skills, use that as a criteria to get them on the register, and require those kinds of skills for people. And my division hires a large number, well, relatively speaking, at least relative to the size of my division, a large number of bilingual local people in technician kinds of positions, and where we can get people with the appropriate skills from the degrees that are required for higher level positions, we've done that. But also within the Department of Fish and Game in the last 2 years has recognized this whole question of local hire as a major area of concern, and we've been taking a number of steps to try and improve our record in those areas. One of the things that we have actually improved it considerably over the last 2 years, our record of that kind of hiring.
Marie Adams.
I'd like to comment on, in doing research, I know that's been, in our experience, I guess when you do contract out to the scientists who bid for the type of research that you're requesting for, and I think it's important that whenever there is something that you can do about local hiring, that it should be done, particularly with people, when you have an opportunity with people who know the area, who have a lot of knowledge about the animals that people are studying. I think in our area, our own native people had been overlooked for some time, and that gap is closing in. But with what Caleb said earlier, that a lot of times they'll bring young college students in to do the kind of work that local people can do, and with local people involved, these people know more about those animals and could put more information into the reports. Like Burton said, science is a real slow process, and I think in doing that kind of research, the opportunity to include people who know their resources very well and the environment area should be considered very strongly.
Steve Benke.
Commissioner's office in the Department of Fish and Game has recognized this and has appointed a task force within the department to look at ways to improve local hire, and we're going to be going out over the next several months, and I think that probably recommendations will be sought from the native community about how to go about that. But some of the changes that need to occur are at the statewide, within the Department of Administration and in state government. There's just a very cumbersome set of procedures for hiring, and that institution has been around for a long time, and it involves unions, it involves a whole range of institutions. Problems that we're trying to address, and I think that your recommendations would be real helpful.
Daniel Gross.
I have just a brief comment to make with respect to the methodologies of wildlife surveys. I'm not familiar with the methodologies which are employed here in this region of the world, but in many areas, wildlife surveys are conducted by persons who are trained to look for animals. Or plant species, and to attempt to assess their frequency distribution over time and space. In doing so, they frequently ignore a very, very lucrative source of information, and that is the actual time that is required to locate these resources. And this is a very sensitive indicator of the abundance of resources. And since there are people who are there who are searching for these resources and whose livelihood depends upon them, one can assume in many cases that there is a very efficient kind of search going on, and that whatever data that they can report about their own subsistence activities would be extremely valuable in assessing the status of any particular species population at a given moment in time. And this can be done on a very formal level through sophisticated sampling. It could also be done informally. One of the ways in South America that we found that's very useful to determine the status of wildlife vis-a-vis any particular native population is to query natives concerning how long they have to hunt before they locate a particular species. In some cases, people report that they go out in the morning and they bag game before afternoon. In other cases, they report that they have to leave their villages and have to stay out overnight. That information is extremely valuable in assessing what the abundance of the species is in a particular area. And if a division of fish and wildlife not only about the present, but also about the past status of
particular populations of game. Larry
Spengler. Thank you. For those of you that have just joined us in the last little while, I'm the Assistant Attorney General that works with the State Board of Fisheries and Game, and I just am moved to make an observation that I've been working with the board since about 1979, and in that time, I've seen an interesting change in the way the board treats information from the Division of Subsistence. When I started working, the boards over the years had only heard from biologists, and they understood biological information, and they could deal with it, and they knew how to weigh it, and they could use it. The Division of Subsistence had only recently been created and only started presenting information, and it was socioeconomic in nature, and the boards couldn't make head nor tail of it. They were really dubious about it. They didn't know how to weigh it. They didn't know how to use that kind of information. It was completely unwanted, in part because it was they didn't know what to do with it. And in the last, over the last few years, from the time that I've become involved, the boards are more and more coming to rely upon the Division of Subsistence to give them information and are finding that kind of information useful. That may be a hopeful sign that, different kinds of information, if presented over enough time period, can find a way of being used in the system. I'm not predicting everything to be rosy, but that has been definitely a change that I've observed.
Thank you. Dolly Garza.
Yes, I would just like to bring up a point in terms of the concerns that natives should have concerning native subsistence uses of the marine mammals. And that that concern is brought about by the state's interest in applying for management of the 10 marine mammals. The state is going through a process of holding public hearings throughout the communities which would be affected by a potential change in management, and are giving the residents there a lot of information on the benefits that would be incurred if management were changed from federal to state hands. They are, however, not addressing the issue that the natives would lose out in the fact that right now they are the only people who can harvest the resource, and if management were changed, that they would lose that right. And that for those species which there is interest in additional harvest, that species would have to be divided among subsistence, recreational, and possibly commercial users. And that is a serious concern that we should be addressing.
Yeah. Tom Lohner.
I guess I would like to see if we can address it for a moment, if that's all right. I was thinking about it from the question that Rosita raised yesterday about the difference between state and federal management regimes. Seems to me that the state of Alaska has claimed often that it can't manage a resource for an exclusive use, such as exclusive for native use. I think that's the extreme point of the minimalist position that we were talking about yesterday, that somehow it's disabled from doing those kinds of things. What I don't understand is how the state can take the position that it can't grant exclusive use on, let's say, for example, the Pacific walrus, and yet it can grant limited entry in a commercial fisheries mode to specific individuals. That is very exclusive. And that and it does it with other resources, not just wild resources. It does it for oil and gas. I mean, I can't punch a hole in the ground and get out the state's oil and gas. I have to go to the state, and the state will award me as a oil and gas company some rights to drill, and it won't grant it to others. I think we have a long history of the state granting exclusive right over resources to specific entities, usually through a sale process or through a limited entry. Now, when I was in the Department of Fish and Game, the Game Division claimed that it could not manage walrus exclusively for Alaska natives under the exemption, and therefore, until that exemption was removed, the Game Division didn't want to handle it, presumably because its constituents were sportsmen paying sports licenses, not Alaska natives who would be able to hunt the walrus without obtaining such a license. And yet, on the other hand, when the federal dollars became available under ANILCA, the $5 million potentially, the Game Division immediately ran around and said, but we have all kinds of species that we manage purely for subsistence, therefore we should get some of that subsistence money to help us in management. We do it solely for subsistence. They also filed a report, I believe it was in late 1980 or early 1981, they did a review of all the resources in the state, game resources in the state, and found a large number of locales and species that they said were fully utilized by Alaska natives for subsistence purposes.
So what I don't understand is, where is the principle that says that the state cannot award limited entry on these resources, which is a form of exclusion, to Alaska Natives for the customary and traditional uses that are already recognized under the state subsistence law, which is presumably still constitutional, and not awarded as a license, which is the way we award limited entry permits in other areas, but just as a recognition of that traditional and customary right that is recognized by the existing law? I guess I just don't understand. It seems to me it's a paradox, and I don't think that somehow we're disabled by the Alaska State Constitution from granting exclusive rights in this area as long as we've granted them in other areas.
Well, I'm going to allow two brief comments on that, because we could spend the rest of the day arguing about what the state constitution means. But Tom's point is that there are any number of subsistence preferences for Native people in Alaska under federal law. Why is it that it would be unconstitutional for there to be such a preference under state law? We'll ask Larry Spengler to speak to that, and then David Case will give David the last word.
First of all, there's no general prohibition on granting exclusive use to various resources. It varies from resource to resource. The limited entry program that Tom mentioned was prohibited by the state constitution because of the prohibition against exclusive right of fishery, and it required a constitutional amendment to allow that limited entry program to be put into place. The oil and gas leases, various other kinds of resources use, may well ultimately reside with one entity, one corporation or one group, partnership, whatever. But the criteria for who gets it is not racial. And the prohibition that we read in the state constitution is that the state cannot distinguish among individuals because of race. If you'll recall, ANILCA defines subsistence uses in terms of rural Alaska residents, and that captures that term captures a fairly large percentage of the Alaska Native population, but it also captures all other rural Alaskans. So it may seem like a hair-splitting reason that we say we can differentiate between rural and urban, because of the different factual situations, the different socioeconomic systems that are present. We cannot, under the state constitution, distinguish between Native and non-Native. So we certainly have been implementing, to the extent some find not sufficient, some find sufficient, ANILCA and the state subsistence law, implementing the rural definition of subsistence uses. That's different, in our view, in a court of law, from the Native-non-Native distinction. And if the federal government wished, under the federal constitution, the federal government could make that distinction between Native and non-Native. But if the management is to rest with the state cannot, and that was exemplified by the Marine Mammal Protection Act. When it required the Native-non-Native distinction, the state, there may have been other agendas by certain parts of the state as far as where they were getting their money and so forth. Whether or not that was the case, there also was this constitutional bar to distinguish between Natives and non-Natives. And that could be done away with by an amendment to the state constitution, and whether that's politically feasible is another question entirely.
Yeah, thank you. David, do you want to make a brief comment?
I'm glad you qualified it. I'm not sure I agree that it would require an amendment to the state constitution, but I said it, I just will say again, as I did at the first, that whatever it is, it's a political problem, and not necessarily, I think, a legal problem. For example, I suspect that the federal government could pass a statute which either required or permitted, I'm not sure which, the state to manage certain species, all species, with a native exclusion or preference. and that, as I read the Supremacy Clause, and again, I haven't researched it, but the U.S. Constitution says that the legitimate laws of the federal government shall be superior to the laws of the states, anything to the contrary, nothing to the contrary withstanding in a state constitution. So I think that it would be possible for a federal law to overcome the state law, the state constitutional prohibition that focuses on race as a category and transform that into native people as a federally protected category. So it's not a legal problem, but the possibility of getting that kind of a law through Congress is a political problem. Now, that I think brings us back to, in my view, the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And what happened there. There was a native exclusion in the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And the state argued at the time the walrus management was originally retroceded to it, that did not, the exclusion did not go with it. In other words, and furthermore, the state couldn't manage the walrus with that native exception. But I think the state could. Frankly, because that was what the law was interpreted to mean, was that the exception went with the retrocession. And the state could have, but politically it was unwilling to do that, in my view. And therefore, the Marine Mammal Protection Act was, I think it was therefore, it was amended in order to get over that political problem. But not, I don't think, really, to get over a legal problem, although that may have been the way it was characterized.
All right, Caleb, we'll give you the last word.